This is a Pinball News production.
Thanks everybody for rolling up. I'm actually here really as a guest of Brendan. This was Brendan's idea. He's done about 98% of the work involved in putting the whole thing together, and he's going to kind of take the lead and host the presentation here. And I will chime in when he asks me to jump up and down, do a little song and dance. I'll do a little song and dance. So we'll see how it goes. We'll be taking questions along the way. So
thank you very much, Chris. Though to be fair, about 96% of our audio clips are music that you wrote, so it's not fair to say that I did most of the work. So yes, Pinball Sound, past, present, and future. We're going to chronicle the last 130 years of Pinball Sound all in the next 90 minutes. So here we go. I do want to start off with an in memoriam slide for one of my favorite pinball artists and designers. We did lose Python Angelo this year to his battle with cancer. So if you see any of Python's games at the expo, make sure you give him a play in the in memoriam. So who am I? Most of you know the gentleman to my right, Chris Graner, but I want to introduce myself a little bit. And here's a picture of me when I was 3 years old at the Hershey Park Arcade, sitting next to a Hercules pinball machine. And fast forward to 2013, there's me next to the exact same Hercules machine in the same arcade. It's actually still there. This is at the Hershey Park Amusement Park. So nice little before and after, and before the beard. When I was 7, my dad made the fateful decision to buy me a pinball machine. Not a good idea, because now I have 15 of them, and I don't have space, so it's a problem. But he bought me this Stern Electronimo machine, and one thing led to another, and I eventually realized some of my favorite games were all games that Chris did wonderful music on, such as Pinbot and Cyclone. Shameless plug, I also designed my own pinball machines. I did a seminar last year about my spiritual sequel to Bad Cats called The Junkyard Cats, which you can download at junkyardcats.net. And I have flyers here for anybody interested. Come see me afterwards. That was the one game that I made, and here's the 30-plus games that Chris worked on. And Chris, I hate to start a question off with, did you ever, but did you ever think that you would amass such a resume of sound design for pinball?
No, I did not. The whole notion of being, you know, where I not never never mind where I am today, where I was in 1986 when I was slaving away as a systems program network tester at AT&T Bell Labs, then Information Systems on contract with a programming system software programming house. And wondering what the hell I was doing, and having a headhunter call me up and say, nah, I've got a job for you doing music, but you don't want it. And I'm like, what is that? And they said, it's a job at Williams, but you don't want it because it's assembly language programming. And I'm like, well, go ahead and send my resume over. I can do some of that if need be. No, you're not really qualified. Forget it. And so 2 weeks later, on the Northwestern Computer Music Bulletin Board, I heard an announcement that the same job was out there, and they were looking for resumes. So I went ahead and sent it in, and you know, really, that is the history. That is the rest is that history. So, back to that stupid recruiter who didn't make a really nice commission on that little project. But
so we're going to get a ton of details as Chris entered the pinball industry and what it was like starting out, and we'll chronicle each as we go through the various games that he did sound for. So how did we meet? Back in 2003, I was doing some, I guess, moonlighting as a writer for Game Room magazine. And I was 15 at the time, and I got in touch with the editor, Tim Ferrante, and said, hey, I'm interested in talking to the guys that, you know, worked on these games. And one of the names that I mentioned to Tim, I said, I want to talk to Chris. I think pinball sound and pinball music and electronic sound for games is a very interesting and interesting topic that not a lot of people talk about. And sure enough, he got me in touch. I wrote Chris a bunch of questions, and you wrote back with 4 pages of content, and we ran the whole thing, and Tim was thrilled with how that came out. And yes, I do have a copy of the magazine here. And yes, you do have to give me your autograph. Thank you. So when you get a chance. So let's talk about our presentation. We are going to tackle every sound that's ever been in a pinball machine, hopefully. Start with electromechanical sounds, the early days. Then we'll move into the early electronic sounds from the solid-state days in the late 70s and early 80s. Then we're going to talk about the Yamaha synthesizer that really kind of added music to pinball. Then moving forward in the 90s, we're going to talk about the DCS and BSMT systems, which kind of dominated the 90s for both Williams and Data East pinball. And then we'll talk about pinball sound of today and what's being done and the new technologies that are available that haven't been available in the past. If we have time, there's also a music software that I use to compose my own music, you know, retro-style, arcade-style music. And if we're left with a lot of time at the end, I do want to show that to you. But if we have like a half hour left, if not, we'll scrap that and take some extra questions. So speaking of questions, I did break this out into sections, and we want to try to hold the questions until each section is done with, and we'll take questions on that section. So I'm going to ramble on for a while before we get to the meaty stuff that Chris can fill us in for. But let's start at the beginning, 1871. This pinball machine on the screen here is Montague Redgrave's Parlor Bagatelle Table, which many people consider this to be the first pinball machine ever made. Before, and the distinction that, the reason that distinction was given to this game is that Montague Redgrave put a spring on a plunger and basically invented the first plunger on a pinball machine, whereas before that, people were using cue sticks to play, you know, Bagatelle. But if you look close, you'll see a bell actually physically on the playfield that if the ball trickles into that slot, the ball would strike the bell and, I guess, you know, make a kind of a dull bell sound. And so that's effectively the first sound effect in a pinball machine. It's kind of rudimentary, but I suppose it counts. Now, if we zoom forward about 60 years, actually that poster, that gentleman on the wall, is Harry Williams. He designed this tabletop game called Contact. And Contact was a pretty big deal at the time because he introduced electricity to pinball in two ways. One of which is that there was an electrical solenoid on the table that would kick the ball out of a hole. And the other one is that there was a small electric bell inside the machine that would ring when you got the ball in the contact hole at the top. So that was really the first kind of like reactionary sound in a pinball. And so we're going to listen to what pinball machines sounded like for almost four decades. And Dave, if the sound is a little low on this, just crank it for us. So that's pretty much it. And that lasted for a while. So these two devices that are on the screen, the bell unit and the chime unit, created almost every pinball sound from 1933 to 1978. And I did leave one out, which is the free game knocker, which is essentially just a solenoid that knocks into a metal plate and makes a loud knock when you win a free game.
All things being equal, I just have to jump in here and say that you know, these things are relative. And the bacteria had the planet to themselves for 2 billion years before they figured out how to make protozoa. So that bell, you know, sort of a blink of an eye, for sure. So just got to throw that out there. Peanut gallery right here on the stage with you, Brendan.
Absolutely. One thought that went through my head when I designed this slide was that even through all the years of electronic sounds and music and voice clips that have been put into pinball machines, these are still kind of the sounds that are synonymous with pinball. When you see a pinball machine in a commercial or a movie or in the background of a TV or in a bar, even if that movie or what have you takes place in modern day, lots of times you still hear these bell sounds, these chime sounds in the background. Even though they're not accurate, you still hear them, and they're still kind of synonymous with pinball. So it really is a statement to the longevity of what these, you know, the cultural impact that just these two devices really had on the way the public kind of perceives pinball sound. So one big question that came up when we were researching this presentation is, what was actually the first game to have an electronic sound. And there were varying reports all over the internet as to what game finally introduced electronic sound in place of a bell. And the first game that I thought it was this game, Spirit of 76. But this is just the first game that had solid-state electronics, meaning it had circuit boards instead of relay logic. But this machine actually has a chime unit in it, because at the time, there was kind of a fear of change. And so people were used to bell sounds, chime sounds, so there wasn't really a big rush to change it right away. So this game actually kept it, a chime unit inside. One person wrote that it was this game, Williams World Cup, but upon further research, this was just the first Williams game that had electronic sound. Then somebody also wrote that it was Electronimo, the first game that I ever owned, but this is just the first Stern game to have electronic sound. But then I found this game called Rally Girl from an obscure French company named Rally that made electromechanical pinball games in the 60s. And I found out that they put all sorts of weird technology in these games, and one of which was this little sound module. So let's So that, as far as I can tell, and I'm a huge nerd about this stuff, so if somebody can, like, correct me, this was really the first electronic sort of sound that a pinball machine ever made, and I couldn't find a machine that was older than 1966 that had a sound like this. So I again, like I said, if you know more than me, I'm curious to know. And then we get into a section of audio that Chris and I both got really interested in doing this presentation, and that was the early solid-state sounds from Williams and how they were made. Now, this game, Flash, was the first game to have sort of a background ambiance or a sound that played throughout. You know, no matter what was happening, there was sound being made by the machine, whereas prior to that, it was only sounds were made when you hit a target. So let's listen to some Flash. So I think Flash is one of the earliest games to have that tilt sound that you hear in a lot of machines all the way up until the 90s. And we're going to talk in a few minutes about how these sounds are actually created. But first we're going to talk about Gorgar, which many of you probably know that Gorgar is the first talking pinball machine. So let's listen to Gorgar speak.
Gorgar!
So, yeah, that's about all Gorgar has to say. And one of the most fascinating things about Gorgar is that they actually designed this smaller daughter board to attach to the existing soundboard. And if you can see in the picture, it has four ROM chips on it. And from those four chips, you've got seven words. And that daughter board is maybe slightly smaller than my phone. So just a little testament of how far this technology has come. But so how were these early sounds created? Chris was able to get in touch with Eugene Jarvis, who was working at Williams at the time, and not many people know that he had a hand in the audio. So we're going to listen to some sounds from Firepower, and Chris is going to tell us what he learned from Eugene.
Remember those? Were those the coolest bloody things? Most of those sounds were made with one of two algorithms that were created by Eugene Jarvis, who is a fabulous musician. He's a wonderful piano player and singer, songwriter. He's married to a wonderful lady named Sasha Gerritsen, who runs the opera department at Northeastern Illinois University here in Chicago, and sings with the Lyric Opera Chorus. And he's just an all-around great musical guy. He and Steve Ritchie and I guess Mark Ritchie actually also played in this. They had a little, they had a sort of a, you can't call it a garage band when they met at Williams. It was a studio band or something like that. But they were a pretty fun, little ensemble. Eugene played a mean synthesizer keyboard. But he's a fabulous programmer and really, understood digital signal processing in a way that, really harked back to the, pioneering work that was being done at places like Bell Labs and the studios in Paris called IRCOM, by people named Max Matthews and LeGeron Hiller, people who really did pioneer the idea that you could use a computer to produce audio. And he took some of those ideas. Mostly the kinds of ideas were taking a small little collection of numbers and throwing them together in odd ways with a small series of things that would repeat over and over again, and then delay them so that you had a sort of a built-in digital echo. There might be several of those running at any given time, and when you do that, you get those kind of sweepy swoopy sounds that kind of go pow, stuff like that. You do that with a filter, and a filter, digitally is nothing more than a little delay. So that's what G-Wave was a sort of a vaguely, roughly programmable delay. The thing that was really remarkable about it to Eugene, and that was when I first talked to him about this in 1986, when I first got to Williams, that was still just as remarkable to him about 3 weeks ago when I talked to him, was how just goofily random the whole process was of coming up with an original sound. He goes, we would sit around there at midnight and smoke pot and throw random hex numbers at this algorithm, and we'd go with an 8C and it would just sound like shit. But then we'd try an 8A and it was unbelievable, and it would last a half an hour. And it was the most incredible thing. And so a lot of the sounds that you hear in these games were things that were created in just like high times at in the back rooms of Williams. At midnight, making wacky random sounds, and that's what a lot of those things are. I think probably that story has a certain amount of apocrypha element to it. I'm sure that as time went on, Eugene sort of got a handle on what kinds of series of numbers would work the best, and a lot of those things are kind of variations on each other. So that was G-Wave, and a lot of the sounds, the Firepower Lock sound. Is one that that's really iconic and that we used over and over and over again at Williams really for the next 10 or 11 years. The other algorithm that he developed was this thing that he called VariWave, and VariWave was nothing more than a switch that threw the electronics from a charged state to an uncharged state, from a 1 to a 0, and held it there for varying amounts of time. And each of the 1 and the 0, the time associated with each of those 1s and 0s, could be controlled by other functions and other numbers. The result of doing this simultaneously with the two numbers was sweeps. And so a lot of the sweepy, swoopy sounds that you hear were things that were produced with VariWave. You sort of got two different tones going at once, and some of those really produced some lovely sort of two voice harmony, I guess you could call it, or two voice sirens, kind of going at once. So a lot of those old sounds were made with VariWave as well. The other sort of component or attribute of those sounds that really is important is the fact that the resolution of the systems and the speed that the processors ran with were just the worst just the worst kinds of things that you would ever put into a sound system if you were designing a sound system. Like, you know, how do we make a really great sounding system? You wouldn't do it this way. We bought this 75-cent digital to analog converter that would actually turn numbers into voltages that you would plug into a line out and run towards speakers.
And the fact that they had about 512 bytes to write all of the audio and the game code on the ROMs, didn't really make that much easier.
They were very, very small footprint, items. So not a lot of numbers available, and then all of that fed through a 75-cent, 8-bit D to A converter that probably had about 5 or 6 bits of linearity, meaning that, the resolution in analog terms, in electronic terms, was even worse than the resolution in digital terms, and each stage of this process degraded the sound more and more and more. And so after having all this degraded in 4 or 5 different ways, you just had this complete piece of shit. But the thing was, that piece of shit was the component of the sound. It's like when you go out in an urban neighborhood and you hear a boombox car playing, every one of those cars sounds different because that giant 18-inch subwoofer that's sitting in the trunk of that car is vibrating a different car. And so every time you hear, or whatever it is the music that they're playing, every one of those sounds different because the trunk of a Chevy sounds different from the trunk of a Saab, and it just does. So those things kind of turn into instruments, and this DAC and this electronic system in those old pinball games and video games turned into their own instrument. They actually tried some of those when it was possible to move those algorithms into a hi-fi space. Eugene tried some of those, and they sounded horrible because they sounded nothing like what they originally were made for. So when you think about these kinds of limitations, you hear of people saying, these limitations are so limiting. They're really constraining me. But the fact is that limitations set you up for the kind of creativity that Eugene exhibited, and that we all, had to exhibit at in various times in our careers. You work and you get the best out of the limited system that you have. And that's exactly what he did with these sounds. So it's super cool.
I think it just makes you realize how much we take for granted electronic sounds in today, in modern culture, and just gives you newfound respect for what they were able to do with such limited memory. And now when you hear those sounds, you can kind of appreciate them in a new way and just how kind of majestic they are considering how they were actually made. But if you're interested in this stuff, go to firepowerpinball.com. There's a great interview with Eugene Jarvis, and he goes into a lot of details about the G-Wave and the VariWave, as well as the actual game programming, because he did that as well. So really cool stuff on firepowerpinball.com. Check it out. So moving on, we're going to talk in this presentation a lot about music, and one of the earliest appearances of music was in a Gottlieb... the Gottlieb Machine Haunted House. So let's give a listen to this. So it's very primitive, but this is sort of, I think it's one of the earliest examples of continuous playing background music in a machine. And we'll be seeing some more innovations from Gottlieb later in the music department. But one thing we wanted to talk about was gameplay interactive sound. And what I mean by that is sound that sort of reacted to the state of gameplay. Up until this point, all the ambiance that was in a machine would just play in the background, no matter what was happening, whether you had a single ball on the playfield or multi-ball, it just played the same thing. But then Space Shuttle came along and sort of changed that. When you have single ball play on Space Shuttle, you hear this. And when you lock the two balls and release the multi-ball, you hear this instead. So it's not music, but it's a very minor thing, but it does sort of pave the way for what would come, where, you know, eventually the different states of play, the different modes of play, would get their dedicated music track. Comet is a game that often gets overlooked in terms of, you know, what it did for sound, but this is actually another early example of like an original musical melody that was written for a pinball machine. So again, super primitive, and by the way, these are all what are known as monophonic sounds, meaning one sound at a time, and if another sound would play, that previous sound would get cut off, and this was just sort of the way things were for a while until we get into multi-layered music synthesizers that kind of got rid of that. So, Chris, I want to get a little philosophical. You know, this is around the point in time when you came on the scene. And we've had over 100 years of pinball sound, and we haven't had music. And now all of a sudden, there's a need for music. What do you feel was the cause or the impulse for that?
I guess, you know, as when we talked about this before, I took a sort of a dry run at this question, and where I came down was, with radio plays, with drama, with opera, with musical theater. And then with movies, the creators of that art were never in doubt of that they were producing fine art, that they were producing something that was going to be an artifact that was going to be known for itself. And I think that the amusement equipment industry was slow coming to that realization. But as these electronic devices came along and they could be more than just ringing a bell, and you were actually able to do something more with them, I think that people just naturally started thinking about the artifacts that they were making, and they started to take on a kind of an importance that then translated to the entire machine. You know, we had a picture of Python before. If you ever imagined that pinball. Or if you ever wondered whether pinball was fine art, all you had to do was spend a few minutes with Python, and you would be able to remove all doubt of that question. Certainly, his influence on me in that regard was pretty profound. So I guess my answer to the question is that at the point where it was becoming possible, we were all becoming aware that we were creating something for posterity, and we started to think about it that way. When you start thinking about something that passes in time, music and sound become very much a part of that experience and shape the emotions associated with them. So I guess that's my answer. For the same reason that film or TV shows or really anything that involves, a drama, a literary, message has sound, pinball and video games also needed to have sound and music.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree. And through your body of work and some of the other composers, there's really no way you can't consider a lot of this music or all of this music to be artistic expression. In just such a unique way, which I've always found fascinating. This is an interesting game. This is a game called Rock that Gottlieb put out in 1985 and often overlooked for one of the innovations it brought to sound technology. But I believe this is one of the first polyphonic music pinball machines.
We got a jargon alert here.
Jargon alert, polyphonic.
Do we understand the difference between monophonic and polyphonic sound? Monophonic being a single sound at a time, whereas polyphonic is obviously many sounds at a time.
Yep.
And this is one
to layer the sounds.
Exactly right.
So let's listen to this, and it definitely has a unique sound that didn't last long, but. So you can hear just with the drum track and the synth layers, that's sort of what polyphonic sound is the ability to layer. And really up until now, you couldn't really do that with the soundboards that, you know, Williams and Gottlieb had. But it wasn't until this game, High Speed, which High Speed introduced a ton of features to pinball, but one of them that gets that sometimes gets overlooked is the fact that it really did have a complete soundtrack and a dedicated audio board just for music. So we're going to listen through the various High Speed soundtrack music tracks, and then we'll talk about it. Chris has an interesting anecdote about that last little guitar riff. That
riff is in every Steve game that I ever did. We had to do it. It was so catchy and so cool, and he could actually play it. So he never got an opportunity to play it for any of the Yamaha games that we did. But I always tried to come up with new and interesting ways to sort of sneak that into all the games.
Was Steve one of the only designers to really have sort of a musical influence?
Oh no. I mean, Mark also was a pretty accomplished bass player. Pat played a little guitar, and Larry, of course, was a big music aficionado. But Steve was probably the one who played the most. He was and is a really fine guitarist.
Okay, so that's going to bring us to our first question break before we start talking about the Yamaha synth. So, do we have any questions yet?
You talked about music, background music being influenced by like Apple and all kinds of things. Wouldn't it technically have been a heavy push off the arcade side, video arcade?
I think the development of electronic music and electronic sound happened both in more or less simultaneously. The technology that made electronic sound possible in pinball was the same technology as it was being used in video games. And so, what I said about, kind of this dawning awareness, certainly happened with anything that involved electronic sound at all. So, very definitely, video games as well.
Actually, it was a similar question because Defender and Joust had that same.
Very much yep. So, yeah. And Robotron, unbelievable.
Eugene Jarvis games.
Exactly right. Dave Thiel in the back room, ladies and gentlemen, another legend of sound.
Yeah.
The first, there are two pieces of music there.
You worked on one of them, didn't you?
For Reactor, 1980.
Really? Okay, I stand corrected. So we need to talk after this. I need some tapes. For anyone that doesn't know, this is David Thiel, currently
Thiel,
works,
yeah.
Thiel, sorry. He does music for Stern currently, and...
Jersey Jack, Jersey Jack, yeah.
I'm getting the no. David, I have a shout-out for you later in the presentation. David is speaking tomorrow at 12:30? Okay, don't miss Dave. He'll be here talking about sound as well. Any other questions?
In achieving this early polyphony, had they switched over to digital chips or was it still analog?
That's a good question. I thought from what I read with Eugene, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the technology to play back audio, like if you were to record a sound and play it back through a digital audio converter, they basically had that technology. The problem was that they had literally no memory to store any of that. So, what what the G-Wave really was doing was sort of manipulating a tiny sliver of a sample. Is that correct in saying that? So if you can elaborate on that better than I can.
I'm not sure whether that was really the question that you asked. Were you asking whether or not whether we used or they used analog electronics as opposed to digital?
Well, I'm looking at in the Yamaha, and I know, or I think more of like a music instrument background, and I know they really developed in the late 80s. They opened up major proliferation of digital instruments. I'm wondering, early on, they had basic proliferation instruments with analog technology, but I wonder if that has anything to do with developing monochromatic.
This touches on the gentleman's question over here about the point where these things sort of emerged. Synthesizers that could be used by musicians. In a performing context, Wendy Carlos, then Walter Carlos, doing Switched on Bach and the Well-Tempered Synthesizer, Moog synthesizers in 1964, 65, 66, became something that people could actually treat as a musical instrument. Those were, as you say, analog instruments where the method of producing sound was actually manipulating waveforms and manipulating voltages. That would then be pumped out of a speaker wire. So that was technology that I, to my knowledge, never made it into a game. If anybody here could correct me on that, I would be interested in knowing the game. But
surely the influences of the early Moog synthesizers, LFO and that kind of thing, certainly definitely made it into,
absolutely.
The principles of those things carried forward.
Jarvis and Tim Murphy and the guys who were working at Williams in the late 70s, early 80s, were definitely aware of the stuff that had been going on at EarCom and Bell Labs and Karma out at Stanford. Eugene had been out there. All of those influences, all the early electronic music that it came out of the Cologne studio and the guys, Pierre Henry and Pierre Schaeffer in Paris, those guys, those were the grandfathers of all the stuff that we're doing. We really owe, to those guys. But it wasn't until it got digital and it got cheap where we could really put it into a game, if that's an answer to your question. Sir?
I might have missed this, but I see the obtaining of the license for KISS by Valley is motivated. I needed to have music in that game, so they did the best they could with the technology at the time.
Yeah, that's a good one. I tried to dive into some of the music theme games like Rock, and we're going to talk about Elvis, and I completely overlooked KISS. That's a great point. And there were a couple of other music theme games, Ted Nugent and Rolling Stones. Off the top of your head,
Captain
those,
Fantastic, or yeah. not? Pinball Wizard, obviously, yeah. and the Elton John game.
Some of those actually have Bell. I think Captain Fantastic is a chime unit game,
right.
So
right.
Really interesting. Yeah, I mean, the technology just, even 5 years later, it wasn't there, If you had take the date that the KISS machine came out, what was it, 78? So even if you went forward 6 years, the technology really wasn't there to really do convincing music yet, which is what our next section is about. Do we have any last questions? The teetering?
Did you have a question, sir?
I have to say,
which game? Sorry.
Beat the Clock?
Exactly.
I think we got it. Do you know what year? Remember what year?
85? Who made it? Was it a Bally game?
Bally game, Beat the Clock.
Would have had music.
Well, I know...
Oh, it was Wolf, okay.
I know the Bally Games eventually ditched their 6801 soundboard and put in the Yamaha board towards the end
right.
that Williams was using. Late 85? Okay.
Okay.
I'm making a mental list in my head of all these other games I got to listen to and get the music down. But any more questions on this section? We are going to break again, so if you have other questions, we can answer them. This is good. Okay, let's move on. Let's move
it's
on.
It's a sound presentation. The idea that yeah.
We're going to start talking about the Yamaha synthesizer, and what better way to do that than the first game that had the synthesizer, Road Kings, so enjoy this. So that was the first time an eight-voice musical track had ever been put in a pinball machine. So again, another machine that sort of gets overlooked as far as pinball history is concerned would be Road Kings. So Chris, in layman's terms, what is the YM2151 synthesizer?
Nice. Great setup. Thanks a lot. This was the thing that, I mean, in really layman's terms, this was the chip and the circuit board that this chip, first lived on in games, was the technology that allowed us to go from having music and sound be a programming problem to having it be a musical problem. And it was at the point where they were putting this thing together where somebody said, hey, we need a composer. And, you know, I was so at the right place at the right time. So that was pretty great. But there are lots of different synthesis methods, and we touched on a few of them with the gentleman's question over here. One of them is FM or frequency modulation synthesis, and I'm going to give you a really basic demonstration of what frequency modulation is. Frequency is pitch, and modulation is changing the pitch. So if I go, you're hearing a sound that's having its frequency or its pitch modulated by this slow wave going, and so that's a wave that's going at about one cycle per second. Okay, so if I go, I'm getting a one cycle per second frequency. I'm getting a frequency modulated by something at a very low frequency. If I double this and go, you get that. And if I speed that up, if I speed this guy up to something like this, which I can't do, I can't do it. I'm not, one of those Indian singers or something like that, do that kind of thing. I can't do it at all. If you speed that modulating frequency or modulating pitch up into the audio range where it's above 32, hertz, 32 cycles per second, what happens is that a new tone is introduced into the signal, and you start getting these things called sidebands. And what those sidebands do is they change the color of the sound in extreme amplitudes of that modulating signal. When that signal is pretty loud, those side tones turn into actual tones, and you hear chords. Okay. What the Yamaha chip did, and what other FM synthesis chips did, was they put a number of these modulating circuits, these little operators, these oscillators that would create these frequencies. They would put four of them together. This guy put four of them together in a single voice, and you could configure them in different ways so that oscillator one modulated two, modulated three, modulated four, and that would be one particular arrangement of those things. There were 32 different arrangements. There were only eight different arrangements.
So it really gave you control over the sound versus what Eugene Jarvis was doing, where he was just sort of guessing.
He was exactly right. We could actually go through and
craft. You could craft the sound more effectively.
So the Yamaha chip that we had, used that synthesis technique, and with those four operators, we could create some pretty interesting stuff in a single tone. Then we had eight stacks of those. We had eight tones that we could produce at simultaneously.
So in addition,
so all that music that you were hearing in Road Kings was, eight of these little FM, guys produced that music.
In addition to just the sound itself, all of a sudden you needed to have musical sequences to feed to this chip. It wasn't just like the G-Wave algorithm where you would put in one number and play the sound and it would be over. Now you needed a whole sequence of notes and tones to feed this chip so it could play. So the analogy I like to use is that the synth chip itself is sort of like a player piano, and the ROM chips that hold the musical data is sort of like the spool that you would put inside the player piano that contains the notes. So there's basically two pieces of the equation that have to be created now, the sound itself and then the music itself, the notes, the chords, the rhythm, all that good stuff. So we're going to talk a lot about Chris's music theory. We're going to do questions at the end of the Yamaha section, so we'll do just dedicated Yamaha synth questions. One of the things I know you're really proud of, especially in the game Pinbot, was the inclusion of segues and transitions and being able to transition from one piece of music to another at any time during the gameplay. So we're going to listen to a little medley of Pinbot transitions, and we'll chat about them.
A little too much bass there, yeah. Transition one. Transition two.
So, yeah, I know that these were two pieces that, seem very short and sweet, but I know that these were kind of breakthroughs at the time.
So the thing that allowed us to do this was the fact that we had a kind of a timekeeper running. You know, we had a metronome and a timer that we were able to tap into, and whatever sort of tempo our music was running at, da 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 da. So this was going on. This beat was doing that, and at the point where we wanted to go back from the multi-ball song to the other song, we were going da 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 da. So the change from one to the other happened on the beat, and the flow of the music never had to stop, and that was something that we worked hard to get. The little nut and bolt that you'd need to know in order to know what the challenge was there was the fact that the moment that the game knew that we were going to change from one state to the other could happen any time, right? You know, a ball went in a hole, it fell down the drain, whatever. You know, at the point where a switch happened and said, hey, we're changing state, the program would then proceed to change state. But we didn't want the program to change the music at that point. We wanted the program to go out and say, hello, it's time for a transition, and have the musical timer go, okay, I'm almost there. Now you can make that change. And so that change would happen. You know, we would get the signal from the game code to make the transition, and we would hold that signal until we were ready, until we got to the next beat. And so that little nut and bolt, bit of technology, bit of intelligence in our program was the thing that we added to Pinbot that wasn't there, that wasn't there before.
So, Chris, when you're working on a new pinball project, like a composition project, especially at this time, how did you typically start, and how long were you usually given to write the music?
Sure. Mostly our work started because this was back in the days before licensed games were anything really at all, leaving Kiss and Captain Fantastic, to one side. We were creating original music, original sounds, and original art for all this stuff. And so the theme of the game was what drove everything that we did. In Pinbot's case, we had Python, really, as I've said elsewhere, doing what I think considered to be his very, very best work. And he was incredibly passionate, incredibly articulate about what it was that he wanted Pinbot to be. He wanted this to be a machine that was coming alive. And that's what we made. It's a really, really remarkable thing. Now I see you. Pretty cool. So he talked about that. He talked about, the fact that this was a game that occurred in space, that wanted to have this kind of mysterious quality to it, a spacey thing, something, an electronic synthesizer was actually really good at sort of, evoking. So... that was where we started with this particular thing that Python wanted to send us into deep space.
So the theme sort of drove.
Absolutely. And over, you know, I mean, the same thing could be said of Road Kings. You know, it was meant to be a kind of a Road Warrior, play on Road Warrior a little bit. So we sort of, you know, got into that kind of hard driving apocalyptic rock yep. sort of groove. And that was where we were kind of at with that.
And typically how long?
You know, I got to Williams in March of 86. And we released Road Kings in, what was anybody, July, August of 86 or something like that. I was coming up to speed, so, you know, that four-month period probably started to get compressed July. Okay, so, you know, that was 3.5 months or so. And Bill Parod was working on and doing most of the sound effects using the old System 11, you know, the G-Wave and the VariWave algorithms and the sounds that had been created for that and, you know, kind of assigning those around the playfield. So Road Kings only had music playing from this Yamaha chip. Pinbot started to use sound. We started to get sound effects happening with Pinbot. The other really cool innovation that we did with Pinbot was... Actually, do we want to talk about this now? Maybe not. I'll come to the other really cool innovation.
So I know Taxi is one of your favorite tunes, so let's take a listen.
Oh, we're moving. Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So this was... when Brendan asked me this in my interview, this was... he said, "What's your favorite thing?" And I, without even hesitation, this song that I wrote for Taxi, you know, absolutely is my favorite. Still is today. You know, what makes a pinball music? You know, you could address, you know, not just this piece, but most of the stuff that I wrote. Most of the stuff I write is pretty thick. There's you know, I try to get quite a lot going on. Some of that is like a sort of a compositional quirk that I have of listening to something and thinking, oh, it needs something else. And I would add something else. And then I would go, oh, well, it needs something else again, you know. And so I would keep on sort of, you know, layering and layering stuff on top. And the result of that would be this, you know, pretty thick composition, quite a lot going on. Turns out that was really clever. I mean, it wasn't clever at all, but it turned out to be fortuitous and good. Because these are pieces of music that last maybe 30 seconds or a minute, and they're going to be heard 1,000 times. People are going to hear those tunes 1,000 times. And it probably would be a good thing if you're going to listen to a tune 1,000 times if there was still sort of something there for you, you know, all those times later that you might never have noticed before because something else, you know, wasn't going on at that moment where you heard it. So my biggest thing about pinball music is not only that it has to have a good energy level kind of at any time, you know, so that's generally tempo and just kind of liveliness, but also that it have, you know, just a fair amount of kind of thickness, you know, specific gravity that's kind of high.
Could you talk about a little bit how you sort of made the bonus count in pinball machines? You kind of turned this into an opportunity for more music.
So when you lose a ball and the tune is going to basically end, at least for a second, we wanted to do something that allowed the flow of the music to continue. So bonus countdowns basically became endings. And so in this bonus countdown, you know, you had a certain number of points that you were being awarded as a bonus, and then you would have a multiplier, and then you would have the whole thing kind of racked up all at once. And in this case, you also had... characters that you were picking up in the Taxi game, you know, you pick up Gorby and Pinbot, and you pick up, you know, Marilyn, and you're, oh, no, it wasn't Marilyn, really. You know, all these, Santa Claus, and, you know, so you pick up these passengers, and each one represented at the end of the little scene, dom, boom, 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 each one of those represented a character. So the bonus countdown that you heard there was the maximum bonus that you could get, combined with the maximum multiplier that you could get, combined with all of the passengers being picked up. And so that was the piece that we basically sort of created, was something that could work with, you know, five different clarinet licks that kind of fell in the middle there, depending on how long your bonus countdown was versus how many multipliers you had. And there were five levels of that kind of introductory piece. And again, those things would happen on the beat, you know, the technology that the intelligence that we built into Pinbot, applied here as well.
It was definitely an interesting musical challenge to sort of create something that is dynamic in a way, and that it's never going to be exactly the same. It's always slightly different based on how well the player did.
Right.
Okay, Black Knight 2000, regarded as one of the best soundtracks ever, and also the first singing pinball machine. So let's listen to some of this. Pretty awesome. this was a collaborative effort between Dan Ford and Brian Schmidt and Steve Ritchie, I'm guessing, had some influence on this. So how often did composers collaborate at Williams?
A fair amount, I guess. Generally, one guy would sort of be assigned to the project, and other people would, you know, occasionally, like in the case of Black Knight, you know, Brian was, you know, Brian had this idea about singing, so he added, you know, he came to Dan, who was assigned to do the game, and they put the singing technology. There was some pretty good digital hoops that they had to jump through to actually make that work without using up all of their speech space. So that was one. I collaborated for most of my collaboration at Williams was done with John Hay. John was a colleague of mine at the University of Illinois in composition school. And I brought him into to my work with Jokers, and then he did a fair amount of work on Jokers. He did a fair amount of work on Earthshaker, and then Williams hired him, and he did a couple of other things. We collaborated again on Funhouse, and then also Dr. Dude. Mostly those were times when. It was just kind of a question of time. You know, we needed to get a bunch of work done, and one guy couldn't do it all in the time allotted. So we split the work up. We did the same sort of thing later on when we got to Twilight Zone and Indiana Jones. Again, it was a super wacko time crunch, and we brought in my friend Rich Karstens to do the same thing.
So in 1990, Williams introduced the WPC hardware platform for their machines and greatly expanded the memory, the amount of data storage for audio clips. So you remember, 11 years prior, we have Gorgar, which can say about 7 words, and now we have a game like Funhouse, which has hundreds of voice clips. So let's listen to a few. So, I know you have some fun anecdotes about working with Ed Boon, but just recording voiceovers in general. Any interesting stories? Well, I know you have the T2 story, but that's a long one.
Yeah. that was what you were hearing there, and the ghastly fidelity of that thing was just kind of like our cross to bear. That sound is produced by a chip made by the Harris digital. Technology company, you know, the Harris Corporation, originally designed for World War II era communication systems, and it was horrible. It was just, you know, it sounds like shit. I'm sorry, just really sounds ghastly. And we really jumped through a lot of hoops to make it even roughly intelligible. We're having some hi-fi issues here, but. The pinball system wasn't really much of an improvement over what's going on, in this kind of context either. So it was horrible. It was just horrible, you know. And one of my colleagues, Robin Seaver, was responsible for coming up with an EQ setting that actually sort of addressed the biggest weaknesses and kind of minimized them a little bit. So that was an improvement.
So I mentioned that you had an interesting story about the Terminator 2 voice clip. If you go on YouTube, there's actually a video of Chris telling the story at Expo from last year. So just type in Chris Graner, Terminator 2, and you'll probably get an interesting story about recording with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it's interesting. Look it up. So here's an interesting game. This is The Getaway, High Speed 2. Getaway is an original theme, but it uses a licensed song. So let's listen. Thank you. So this is like, there's a lot of license-themed games out there based on movies or even bands that use a lot of their music, but this is a unique case where a ZZ Top song was put in an original themed game. And Chris was telling me earlier that the composer of this game, Dan Forden, who did the rest of the music, you know, wasn't exactly thrilled with having to put it in the game. But was this ever worrisome to you that they were using a licensed song instead of an original song?
Well, we always thought that we were there to kind of, you know, express our art or something like that. You know, we thought of ourselves as artists, and, you know, this idea that we would have to express something else, some other art, you know, was something that we, you know, weren't really excited about. You know, we have gone way, way down this road at this point in pinball, you know, with all the licensed themes that we're doing. But and we still, you know, some of us old timers hark back to the days that we got to do original titles. And maybe that'll happen again someday, huh, Dave? So, you know, we're looking forward to some of that, you know, kind of happening again. You know, we think of Funhouse and Fishtails and Taxi and some of these things as, you know, as really nice pieces. Pinbot, obviously, you know, things that really stand on their own. And, you know, we think so anyway. So whenever this sort of thing happens, you know, there's a little bit of a, you know, the fact is, you know, LaGrange is an awesome, awesome song. And, you know, looking back on it, it's pretty cool that we got it in. And, you know, Dan did a great job arranging it. And so, you know, it's what it is.
So that sort of ties into the next question, which was, what are some obstacles or challenges for pinball when composing and doing sound design?
8 voices, no reverb, no processing, limited time, too many songs to write, too much other stuff to do. You know, like I said, limitations. They're the kind of things that frame the scope of the work. You know, that continues to this day. You know, we would all still be working on whatever it was that we were working on yesterday if the techs and the marketing people and the salespeople didn't come to us and say, okay, you're done. We've got to sell it. We're shipping it tomorrow. So you're done. That's when you get to be done. So that's always, you know, to me, that continues to be the biggest challenge is, you know, how much can you put into something and still maintain your sanity and still meet your deadlines and still, you know, feel like you went home at the end of the day and did something cool.
So we are running a little short on time. So can we just do the one question on the Yamaha?
I wanted to know, developer kits, how did you translate your music into the ROMs? I know this Yamaha chip is not an easy chip, but it's very specialized. Did you ever put any subliminal messages in your code?
I buried Paul. You mean like that? No. We typed notes in into a text editor, and basically they were macro assembler commands. It was the structure of the note lists that we were creating were not quite like MIDI, and so translating that idea of a MIDI instrument was something that didn't really work that well. The whole kind of time frame based structure and how MIDI instruments, MIDI synthesizers, you know, actually worked didn't work so well for our kind of interactive scope and the amount of memory that we had to store that stuff. So you know, we basically invented our own language and that's how we did it.
So we do have to move on because I want to get to some of the really cool stuff we want to show you. Real quick, now we have the new DCS system that came on the scene in 1993 to replace the Yamaha synth. And again, in layman's terms, what were the advantages of the DCS system?
So the Yamaha chip was a synthesizer chip, and so the programming that I was just talking about was stuff basically throwing notes at the synthesizer and asking the synthesizer to play those notes. DCS, digitally compressed sound, is really basically just nothing but a not very hi-fi four-channel audio recorder or audio playback unit. And so
the task for the sound guys became produce some audio in whatever way you want to do it. You know, go into a studio and with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and produce a track, or go into your, you know, your virtual studio, which is what we all had, and make a track of music, and then put that onto a track of, you know, one of the four that we had available in the DCS system.
So the first DCS game was Indiana Jones, so let's take a listen to the difference. So you can hear the inclusion of actual, you know, trumpet sounds and timpani sounds that really weren't available. But apparently Twilight Zone was slated to be the first game to use the DCS system. Chris, why don't you tell us what happened there?
Well, so we were actually working on both of those games at the same time. We were using sampling synthesizers to simulate DCS while the technology was being developed. So I wrote music for both of these games. I guess I was mostly working on Twilight Zone to start with. And we had just taken music from the Indiana Jones movie and handed it off to Brian Schmidt to use for development of Indiana Jones. But for Twilight Zone, we were making original music. The Golden Earring tune that Pat brought, that is now the main play tune of that game, was something that it was Pat's idea, and I hated the idea. I had no real affection for the tune, and I just didn't, you know, wasn't interested. And so I said, let me just try some stuff. You know, you got to trust me. We've worked together for a long time. Let me do some stuff. So I did, and it just never really quite worked. You know, I had several different versions of the song. The one we're going to play for you tonight was the one that actually lived in the game for a while. And at the point where we finally bailed on DCS for Twilight Zone because the technology, the board just wasn't ready. It wasn't working well. It sounded horrible, and it needed more work. It needed more time. We had to make a conversion and switch everything back over to a Yamaha system, which was no fun at all. And for a long time, I basically just couldn't listen to Twilight Zone at all. In retrospect, listening to the stuff I dug off of this DAT tape, you know, a month or so back, we did a really good job. By the time we got to Twilight Zone, we really knew how to make that chip sing. And, that's a really good sounding game.
So, is a special treat that Chris saved all the original DCS audio from Twilight Zone and transferred the tape and sent it to me, and we're going to listen to it. So what we're going to do is we're going to play the original Yamaha version of the sound that ended up in the game and then juxtapose that with the original DCS. So here we go. If you look on the screen, I've detailed exactly where in the gameplay that comes from. So there's about 10 of them that we're going to listen to all.
One of my favorite Yamaha moments right there. It's a pretty great guitar solo, if you don't mind my saying so.
Yeah, it's awesome. And this might sound a little different, but this was the main theme in the machine for many months during development.
We'll be right back. instrument. This is like the best instrument I ever made. So bad.
Made it for Steve Ritchie.
Huge thanks for Chris for digging that out. I think that stuff is really cool. So.
Thank you. Nope. Thank you very much.
I was going to break for questions here, but we are very tight on time. We have a few more slides to get through. But the one question I'll ask and answer for you is, how can I get that in my Twilight Zone machine? And Chris definitely does have plans to release all the audio that he had on that tape. And I'm sure someone is going to do their damnedest to make it into a mod and... what do you say, like a year's time before somebody has it in their machine? I don't know. You know, but it will be released, so just stay in tune for updates. So we want to talk about some other composers. Chris has done some incredible work, but there were some other composers at Williams that also did some great stuff, including Dan Forden, who you might know from Mortal Kombat fame. And I contacted Dan, and he wrote back with a few of his favorites. We might not get to all of them, but I'll play a few. So these are some of Dan's favorite tracks with some anecdotes that he emailed me. So enjoy. So we're a little tight on time, so I'm going to skip the rest of the Forden's favorites here so we can talk about this guy, Brian Schmidt, who worked for Williams from 1987 to 1990 and then jumped ship over to Data East for most of the 90s. And Brian developed this board, the BSMT audio board, which was used in a ton of games and also a bunch of Stern games. So we're going to listen to Batman, which was the first game to use this board, so you can get an idea of the quality. So sort of in between the quality of, I'd say, the Yamaha chip and the DCS system. So we're going to skip Apollo 13 here. And, I got to give a shout-out to this Sega game. If you've never played Crew Ball for the Sega Genesis, you need to go and buy a copy because Brian Schmidt and Mark Sprenger, who did artwork for Pinball, both worked on this game, and I think Brian won an award for the soundtrack in this game, and it probably doesn't cost more than $10. So if you have a Sega Genesis, you got to go buy Crew Ball. So we didn't get to mention a lot of other composers that did some great work and in sound design over the years, and here's sort of a down and dirty list of what we could come up with of other people who were really influential in this area of the industry. So if you're taking notes, type any one of these names into the Internet Pinball Database, and you'll find some great resumes of games that these gentlemen did music for. So let's talk real quick about Stern and your return to composing for pinball music.
More musical bonus countdown material there. Pat Lawler rescued me from a very tough situation that I was in over at IT. Somebody was trying to get me fired, and it was a really bad year, the last year that I was there. And in the middle of it, Pat came along and he said, "Hey, I'm doing a game for Stern. It's a Monopoly game. You want to, you know, are you in?" And I'm like, "Yeah, oh my God, yes, am I in?" So that was my that was the beginning of the end for me at IT, and worked my way back to Stern, and then basically I did that one, and coming around on Simpsons, basically starting with Simpsons, and then all the way up to World Poker Tour, I did all of their games. So all that stuff except for World Poker Tour was BSMT. All of those, the Sopranos and Lord of the Rings are probably my favorites, but it's a pretty nice run. Working with Lonnie is awesome. Working with Lyman and Dwight Sullivan and Keith Johnson especially, great stuff. Really, really, it was a good period of time for sure.
So let's get through the end of this. We are going to skip over Elvis. And even today, Chris is still composing for pinball, and one of his most recent
Before yesterday, anyway.
One of his most
recent... Not today, Joe, really, not today. I'm not doing it today.
If you've got a chance to play the new Wizard of Oz machine, Chris did all the audio on that, so this is our last clip, so let's listen to a medley of Wizard of Oz sounds.
Shout out to Harold Arlen and Herbert Stothert on the arrangements and the compositions.
So Chris anyway. is gonna kill me if I don't mention that the audio fidelity on these Wizard of Oz tracks is absolutely crystal clear. It's we're getting a little distortion in here, but if you get a chance to listen to this machine or some clean audio rips of this music, I mean, it is the fidelity of the sound is absolutely impeccable. So. Chris, to wrap things up, you want to give us sort of the state of pinball sound today?
Well, I can speak to the Jersey Jack system, and I understand that there's new Stern stuff coming, new Stern audio hardware and software coming out. If it's not out at this point, it's going to be soon, and I can't really speak to that at all. But the Wizard of Oz system was a straight, uncompressed stereo 44-1 16-bit. CD quality audio, and all of the tracks that you were just hearing were produced, kind of with that in mind. So, it's really is a, there's no excuse anymore. We can do the best stuff, and it's really exciting time, for pinball to be able to do that. It's great stuff. All these people coming in to hear the end of my talk. It's really awesome.
The very end. As I mentioned earlier, shout out for David Thiel, sorry, and don't miss his seminar tomorrow, Friday at 12:30, and sort of like a continuation, I guess, of what we were just talking about.
A little bit, yeah. I think we've got like 2 minutes. If anybody's got a quick question, sir.
Who wrote Joker's Wife? Is there a difference on the Joker's Wife? Why was this changed?
Jokers was sort of one of those intermediate, you know, we had a series of interim soundboards, and Jokers was one of the ones that made it into production. It was really nothing more than a rearrangement of technology. We were losing the System 11 board that produced a bunch of those sounds, and we had to figure out some way to combine it all over on one board, and that was the Jokers board. One more question.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thanks for coming.
This was an absolute thrill.